and Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and welcome to my show tonight. Tonight I have with us Julia Asante. How do you say your last name, Julia?
Asante.
And we're going to talk about her new book, The Last Frontier, Exploring the Afterlife and Transforming Our Fear of Death. And Julia's book's a really interesting book. You know, I don't really have very many books that or very many interviews that aren't something about quantum mechanics or alternative medicine. So it's a little bit different from our show, but I found it certainly worth the read and the listen. So I invited Julia to come on and wanted to share her information with you.
Thank you,
Julia, for taking the time to come on my show. And if you would, before we get started with the interview, tell us a little bit about you so we know who you are and where people can find you.
Okay, well, firstly, my website is www.juliaasante.com. Very simple.
Spell it, please.
A-S-S as in Sam, A-N as in Nancy, T-E.
And it's Julia,
J-U-L-I-A. J-U-L-I-A.
Okay.
Right. And I've been working as a professional intuitive and medium since the mid-1970s. And I'm also an academic with a PhD from Columbia, and I've taught at some major universities. My specialty is ancient Near Eastern studies, history, language, cuneiform language, and archaeology. So I've used the skills from that and my skills for examining an exotic culture to look at the afterlife.
How did you come to do that? You don't just go do that one day. There's got to be something, a precedent.
Yeah. Well, I was born in heavy mourning. My mother's father and her baby son died just before I was conceived. So there was always a leaning towards death and the mysteries of death. But it was when I was working as a professional intuitive, I started getting more and more information about what was going on with people after they passed. And in some cases, they were really in pain. So it was in the early 80s, I think, when I first started in a very dedicated way to work with people after they passed to help them adjust, to understand what happened. This is all a problem of how we deny death while we're alive or even while we're in the dying process.
So I'm sorry, go ahead.
In the 90s, a man I cared very much for died, and I was not able to let him in after he died to communicate with him for various reasons, largely taking care of his estranged family and doing his funeral and things of that sort. And the agony on his face when I finally did let him in, the agony that told me what it means to the deceased when they're trying to reach us and we dismiss them, was so extreme. And when I finally did let him in, he could perceive and I could hear him, I could, well, rather understand him, I could see him and interact with him. This look of agony turned into euphoria and gratitude. And that was an hour-long, unbelievable session with him, of joking and disagreeing and even arguing and exchanging all kinds of love. And I thought, anyone can have this. We are all mediumistic. Any one of us can do this. And that was the real motivation for writing the book, but not necessarily the motivation for working with the afterlife.
Now, I'd like to talk just a moment, not spend a lot of time here, but when you say you're in academia, what do you do in academia? You have a PhD?
Yeah, from Columbia.
You have a PhD in Columbia?
Yeah.
And I noticed that Larry Dossey, who we all know and love, wrote you an endorsement for your book. So
right.
You're not just, I guess what I'm trying to point is, you're not just somebody out here that's just throwing out something that you think. This is something that you've spent time and research with and spent your life studying and maybe reproducing it over and over.
So and because of my background, for me, the Bible is a new work. I go 2,000, 3,000 years before B.C., and I have all available to me the earliest traditions of the afterlife and the incantations or whatever means people used in Mesopotamia and in Egypt, very ancient Mesopotamia, ancient Egypt, to communicate with the departed and why all of that changed. So the whole history and the social history, the attitudes around death, around communication with the dead, around dying, are available to me to scrutinize and to try to understand why we've come to where we've come, which is so much denial around the dying process. We've turned it into a pathology. And in terms of after-death communication, it's astonishing, I must say, Eva, how many people, when I work with them anyway in workshops, I'm getting 100% of people being able to communicate with the exact person they most wanted to reach. It's just amazing what's happening now.
It doesn't surprise me at all. I totally am with you there. So let's just start at the beginning. Let's not start at the dying yet because we're not there. So let's start before one dies. What is there some indication that it might be coming that we can look that'll give us a clue that someone we love may be about to die or that we're about to die so that we can take care of what we need to take care of?
Well, you know, that's
that make sense?
Were I to say something, it would be an enormous generality. Yeah? One of the things that if you are psychically inclined, the diminishment of an aura that is only half an inch away from your body is a good indication that somebody's going to die, even if it's an imminent accident. On the other hand, the general dying process in old age involves changes in the concept of time, accelerated growth, what I would call orchestration. The psyche orchestrates events so that the person, even if it's going to be a heart attack coming out of nowhere, still manages to bring the people before he dies or she dies, bring in the people he or she wants to see, that needs to reconcile with or to say goodbye to, even before they know they're sick or before they know that they're going to die from an accident or whatever. We see a lot of this. In the same way that you see a lot of situations in which it's a train crash, statistically, very often have very few passengers.
Really?
For some reason or another. People know when it's going to happen. And there's an avoidance or agreement to participate.
That's
so
very interesting.
Yeah, that's statistically true. It's also true for airplanes. For instance, you might be heading out on a train for your usual morning train to work, and suddenly the telephone rings and you can't make it, or the dog gets sick and you have to go to the vet, or something tells you you shouldn't go, or you want to go later, and to find out that that train crashed. It's very common.
That's very interesting. I have a friend, just today I was talking about this. His name is Tom Justin, and he was supposed to be on one of the 9/11 planes, and that morning, for whatever reason, he decided that he wanted to drive and to take a long coastal drive to get to where he was going instead of getting on an airplane.
Yeah,
and to know that
there were not many people on those planes.
Yeah. So
Larry Duffy wrote a book on this,
on
premonitions.
Yeah, I've interviewed him about that book, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really amazing book. So another thing that I've heard that people do is, like, get legal affairs into order.
Yeah.
Things like that, and I'm asking these specific questions for a reason, because I have someone in my life that's dying, and I want them to listen to your show, because this person has a tremendous fear of death. So that's kind of why, the last time we tried to do a show, it didn't work. Something happened with the internet or something. I can't remember what it was, but something happened, and now it's time. and it just happens to be synchronistic that you're on my show right this minute and this
right.
person is dying.
Right.
So I wanted you to help ease this person's fear of death. That's my brother. So you talk about they get prepared, and then what happens next?
Well, you know, it reminds me of what you just said. Sometimes they'll start fixing the house up. There's a lot of accelerated growth that goes on. Like the sort of thing that happens when you're facing a deadline, you go into high action. On the other hand, if there's a great deal of denial or fear of death, maybe none of these preparatory steps will take place. You know? And there is a great deal of that in this culture.
Do you know if it hurts to die?
I do know that once the fear of death is gone, there's acceptance and reconciliation. There's little or no pain. Also, when there's comes to something like being hit by a car, a person usually pops out of the body before they feel anything. This is also true in something, for instance, like people who drop from the World Trade Center. They're probably gone before they hit the pavement.
Really?
They're out.
I've always wondered about that.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of that. And having talked or communicated with people who just died, pain is not something that they talk about. Even people who've died by shooting themselves in the chest in suicide, no issue with pain whatsoever.
Yeah, I guess the worst pain you can ever have is slamming your thumb with a hammer, huh?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. But we are afraid of the pain.
Uh-huh.
We're taught about the pain because that's part of the fear of death package that we're being sold all the time. And it exacerbates the pain tremendously. It's the same with birth. In Western societies, the dramatic presentations of painful births are so, we suck them in. You know, they're hypnotic. And we have more pain in the West than there is for women giving birth in other countries, or even historically. Mesopotamians gave birth, women gave birth on a pair of bricks, got up and walked away. So this is a lot of this, the pain is enculturated to a great extent.
So you brought up the topic of suicide, and that's a very interesting topic and a very fearful topic, and especially today's society. What happens, or what can you tell us that you believe happens if someone commits suicide?
For each suicide, it's the afterlife is different. I can only make two very gross generalities, in that in accidental suicides, such as in overdoses, are more problematic generally. But I have seen people who are in suicide, have committed suicide, and are sort of suspended. They don't want to go forward because they're afraid of punishment, or they're afraid of even being alive in the afterlife, truthfully.
Mm-hmm. So
on the other hand, I've seen people who have had extremely aggressive suicides, throwing themselves in front of a subway, for instance. They can be incredible communicators, full of energy, remorseful, you know, feeling that their reasons were absolutely idiotic. They understand that almost immediately. And it takes some time for them to slow down and adjust to the circumstances that they themselves created. I've also seen someone commit suicide in such a high state of self-loathing and passion that when he went over, he still wanted to commit suicide. He couldn't get rid of himself.
That's what I thought.
It was really, really sad.
So And I understand that everything is somewhat speculative here, but since I've had the same experience as you, it makes me makes them be more believable to me.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine that if someone were so miserable in life because of some kind of terrible emotional pain or whatever, but yet they were spiritually awake, and it was to the point not where they were depressed because of some neurotransmitter imbalance, but just that they longed to go home. Do you think that makes a difference?
yeah.
that they were to commit.
Yeah. And cultural attitudes make a difference.
Mind make a difference?
Your state of mind makes a difference. The problem with the suicide situation is people commit suicide usually in an extreme situation of isolation, feelings of isolation and secrecy. And if that isolation continues after passing, it can be difficult for people to move in, alive or not alive people, in our sense, non-physical helpers or people still in the body. It can be difficult for them to move in and assist the suicide person. Because of this cocoon-like isolation that these are often committed in. So others are sometimes actively seeking help or even a way to come back right away. There's a real panic and a lot of lack of logic and that sort of thing. They can be totally wild after they do it. Not all. So there are many, as you propose now. Sure, if a person has a feeling of what's to come, suicide can be, in fact, appropriate. If we have this idea that life at all costs, no matter how devalued it is still superior to death, and that actually isn't true. And in some ways, since we do choose our own death and we do choose the manner and the way we die, it's always suicide, ultimately.
Yeah,
in some odd way. So it is really a matter of your focus, your emotional attitudes about what it means to die. In many cultures, suicide is not considered a bad thing. And in those situations, it's going to be much easier.
That's very interesting. So
yeah.
Is there evidence that one can control the timing of one's death?
Oh, yeah, lots of it. Lots of it.
Tell us about that.
There's evidence of people knowing exactly which minute. There's evidence of people who die much earlier than they should have, maybe 6 weeks, 2 months earlier
Why do you say that? I don't understand that.
Yeah, okay, someone has a prognosis of, they're told, you've got 2 months left to live, right? They know what the disease is. It's, say, cancer, the most typical, and how fast it's moving. So they're given 2 months to live. But the circumstances are such that dying earlier would save a lot of people a lot of problems. In one instance, for instance, that I know of, this woman died within a week, not 2 months, but within a week, because her son had to leave her and was in tremendous conflict about leaving her and not being there when she died. He had to go to another country for work, and he couldn't change it. So she just died while he was there, and he could mourn and set up the funeral with her husband. It worked out perfectly. But normally, delay is more often in the situation where you don't die, you keep waiting until that person you need to reconcile with comes in. That's the more usual situation. But it can work anyway. And the dying do want to talk about this, by the way. They don't do it because we won't do it. It's too stressful for us, although we say we don't want to stress the patient, we don't want to stress the sick person, but they do want to discuss what's going to happen after they're gone, commitments to try to communicate, things of that sort, family, all important in the dying process. The avoidance that we have around talking to the dying or just talking about dying in general is outrageous. On the other hand, we're completely and entirely obsessed with death, especially news and entertainment industry, the health industries, anti-aging industry, the medical, pharmaceutical, insurance, even the way we educate, the way we understand history, the way we understand the origins of humans, all of this all of these institutions can exploit us through that fear. Certainly, religions have been doing it forever, but we know that, but we don't look so much in the secular sectors of society to see how much we are exploited by the fear of death. is very schizophrenic. So we have this obsession and this fear. We don't talk about it in real time, in real situations, but we are obsessed with it day in and day out in terms of our culture.
So in your book, you talk about, you use the phrase, the final push. What do you mean by that? What is that?
In the very end stage, sometimes a person is weak and will just fade away. Sometimes that person needs a shot of energy to get out. And so it is not atypical, for instance, for the final push where a coma patient will come back and wake up and then die. That would be a final push. Another one that's very that is characteristic is for someone to get out of bed and fall and then die. Or in the story that I used in the book is of a woman who couldn't stand one more injection, got the injection, and then died. And I think sometimes that people who are overprotected, especially in coma, have more difficulty because they don't have access to that extra shot of energy that'll help them out.
And,
so that's what I mean by the final push. You do see it. You see it in action. There's a kind of a heating up of energy very often just before dying, sometimes remarkable clarity. Even people with Alzheimer's so severe that they can't speak may suddenly speak, and then they die. It's wild. Also, final push can come from one of the most common of all deathbed phenomena is the visitation of the deceased who come to soothe them, to escort them, and that can be the final push, that emotional charge of seeing someone you haven't seen vividly there. And a lot of nurses and medical personnel are also beginning to see these deceased. And that person is there sometimes to tell you it's not time yet, but usually as a kind of escort service. And you'll see people with their arms out. I'm coming, Harry, just give me one more minute, and 1 minute passes, and they die. That's another kind of momentum that allows a person to get out. In some cases, for instance, with my mother, she had such devastating strokes that she was a vegetable, you know, the absolutely comatose, and she was pulled out. That sounds a little funny because...
What do you mean?
When a person is in or not in the body is not as simple as people think. Let me just say that.
What do you mean? Elaborate, please.
Well, for instance, I've seen people in comas who are physically still alive or with Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia actually operating outside of their bodies as though they were already passed. And with clarity, even able to converse, to tell you what they need, what they would prefer done, absolutely conscious.
Now, do you...
But their bodies are still alive.
Do you have to be in some kind of altered state, or you just do this, you know, whatever, when in your normal state of being?
It's a kind of concentration, Eva, but we're always in some kind of altered state.
Okay.
It's a concentration, a little bit of a shift away from... normal modes of perception. Yeah.
So you also talk about... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I finished.
Okay. You also talk about going through the threshold and a period of adjustment. What is that, and what does that do for the soul that departed?
You know, when you are around a deathbed, and I'm sure many listeners have had this experience, as death approaches... every moment becomes longer and more meaningful, more pregnant. Every gesture of a dying person, every expression on his or her face, all of these things become more meaningful because the moment grows more spacious, it gets bigger. And that's the power of the threshold opening. And very often, well-known deathbed phenomena is for the dying to see that vista where they're going open up. So we all benefit from this. It becomes very magical, those last moments. At that point, the dying are just wanting to slip through, wanting to slip away. They feel it. It's like a pull. And as they go through, and this is true even if you're, I work with a lot of people to go through conscious death stuff, and I can do it even while they're in full health. And almost all cases, they go through that so-called threshold, and they leave their bodies, and they begin to float into something that starts to feel just so secure and so warm and so loving, and then they begin to see people there, or animals, your pets. It's a glorious thing, and it starts to get filled with a kind of a luminosity that grows as well. So there's this extreme sense of safety. The pain certainly is gone. This is not always true if a person is anxious or in denial or very unresolved or in a rage or whatever it is. Sometimes those emotions or those problems or conflicts such as great feelings of guilt can prohibit a good passing. But for the most part, for the majority, it's as I just described it, this deep, abiding sense of safety and freedom and peacefulness and release. There are other kinds, can be like a shot through go through the threshold, you just shoot out in like an intergalactic space. And they're the high charge ones. They just can't wait to get going.
I'd like to ask you a question about an experience I had, and see if you can tell me what you think it was. I had one time I was going through a really bad divorce, and I decided that no matter what, that I was going to be happy, and I was going to be in the exact moment all of the time, and that I was not going to experience what was or what might be. And I was going to make this everything be peaceful for my family and my house, and I wasn't going to fight, and I was going to try to salvage this marriage. So one day I get into my car.
I didn't get that last part.
Excuse me?
You were going to fight and what?
Make the marriage work.
Okay.
I didn't want to get the divorce, but I didn't have to. So one day I get in my, but it was very miserable, and I was very prone to depression at the time. But I worked hard to stay in the moment. So one day I get into my car, and I drive a couple of blocks away from home, and I pick up my kids, and on the way back, I'm sitting out at the red light, and I had a car that had a sunroof in it. And all of a sudden, I don't know how to describe this, but it was like I was a couple of miles up in the air.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
But I was still holding on to my steering wheel. And I suddenly thought, oh, my God, the car is going to wreck and my kids are going to be hurt. And as soon as I did that, as soon as I had that thought of fear, I snapped back in my body. What happened to me?
You left
was
your
I
body.
Was I leaving? Was I dying?
Oh, or? Yeah. No. It's quite common to just shoot out like that.
What is it?
You know, out-of-body experiences are quite common, and you can even train yourself to do them. This is what a near-death experience is, but where a near-death experience and an out-of-body experience differ is still something we haven't really explored well enough. So shooting out, some people will actually go to a historical place or another part of the globe. Most people just shoot out and see themselves, see their bodies, and get a perspective on their lives is quite different. I think that's more or less the purpose for you, is to look down.
It felt like bliss. I mean,
yeah.
It felt like I had, it was like, maybe like one of those bungee things you jump off of. You went way
absolutely
up and then you snap back.
Yes.
It was just really weird. Okay. I don't want to stay focused on me. I just thought to ask you about that. Could you tell us
it's
about...
No, exactly right. It's that bungee feeling. It's
exactly
you
want. That
pull back in, yes. But this is what we do when we wake up in the morning. You know, sometimes when you wake up, they say you wake up on the wrong side of the bed. You can wake up when you slam back into your body. And it can wake you up.
My little boy does something. That brings up another topic. I have a little boy, and I will, before I go to bed, I always get up and go in and wake him up and take him to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Sometimes he's not home.
Right.
And he gets very combative, and it's like he's looking through eyes and nobody's home. Is he not there?
That's right.
And the next morning, he will not remember.
Right. because he wasn't
Is he not home?
Right, he's not home. This is what I was trying to say before, that when we're in the body and not in the body is really something we don't recognize. An infant is very rarely there. But a person can operate without being in there totally.
He's 13.
Right. Yeah, yeah, I understand that. You know, people don't realize that's what Socrates did to get his wisdom. He went out of his body. And this was the ancient way of learning. There was no, you know, neighborhood library or internet. So you went out of your body to find out what reality was. You became a mystic. And so, as I said, it is trainable. There are even institutes like the Monroe Institute here in America that will train you to do it. It's fascinating stuff. And it's an ability we all have and an ability we all use every night when we go to sleep.
Could you tell us the story of Michael, who underwent cardiac resuscitation?
Well, he's the person I was referring to when we first started talking. This watching him die, watching him leaving his body, and floating upwards and sort of turning around and looking down with his eyes bulging like, oh, my God, who's that? Or, oh, is that me? You know? This distancing thing is known from near-death experiences. It's known from after-death communication, and it's known from past life therapy when you take people through a past life death. This turning around and looking at the body, ah, is that me? And I saw him do that, and then they applied the resuscitation paddles, and he would come in, a huge amount of red all over the place, and then he'd start to slowly go back out again. And they did this a series of times with the same red atmospheric flash until he finally just floated away, just got out. So the paramedics, for instance, who are working with situations in which a person dies in an accident or whatever, often feel the presence of that person watching as their bodies are picked up. Or even if they die in bed and a paramedic comes and gets them, or ambulance drivers or whatever it is to pick up the so-called corpse, sometimes the dead person will follow it. They're curious. It's a big moment in their lives.
Is there any indication where the soul exits the body?
Very often through the head, but not always.
Where else could it leave?
Sometimes it goes through the chest.
Okay.
That would be the second. But it's usually up around the head area. Kind of a, some people see it as a wispy, almost smoky type thing. It's called, when you are witnessing this, it's called a shared death experience. And as I said, more and more medical personnel are admitting that they're seeing it. For me, I don't see wispy. I see the actual energy body leaving. The face and the whole business. Very often, a moment or so after they've exited, they seem to disappear as though they're changing frequencies or something. They become almost invisible to me for a second or so, and then I can continue to follow them afterwards.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Let me put it this way. We know it's possible. How does one, if one wants to reconnect with their deceased person, can you give us some steps to do that?
Well, I do that quite thoroughly in the book, right? There's a whole section preparing people for this in the book. And it's a very successful method. Well, there's several techniques, but my methods have to do with proceeding from your most powerful emotion. Many other people think it's more meditative, but the truth is it's your need that's going to bring that deceased person to you. And your deepest emotion, and it doesn't have to be a positive one. You can be enraged or full of self-pity or full of grief. Now, while I'm saying that, I just want to give listeners a tip that if you are in deep grief, a surge of grief, a wave of grief, chances are very, very likely that the person you're grieving for has just showed up. And that it's kicked off a grief wave because you don't know how to communicate. You don't realize that that presence is there. You just associate it with loss and go into grief. So I just wanted to mention that. But to call in someone, it's quite an elaborate process of preparation. When you get good at it, you can do it in restaurants. That's not a problem anymore. But in the beginning, you should make a sacred space, just a sense of security and not being interrupted. And you make sure that you kind of set the scene with that whatever happens should be for the best good of all things. So that you set that kind of intention. Then you call on the person with the strongest amount of emotion you can muster. Need. It must come from real desire or need. A kind of curiosity is not going to help much. Whatever, if you start to feel a presence, focus on where that is, begin speaking. Internalize whatever you are sensing. Look for images in your head. Listen for messages in your head. That will keep the communication going longer. It'll sustain it and give it more momentum. Articulating is very, very important, asking questions, but the most important thing is genuine emotion.
Okay.
And intention.
What do you mean when you say thickening the feel?
That is just pumping up your electromagnetic field. It's really
how
all
do you
that.
Do that?
Yeah, just sort of imagining yourself as a kind of a hose system where, you know, just creating more energy. You can do it by holding your two hands just like 10 inches apart from each other, palms facing each other, and trying to get a flow going between your two hands, and that'll get the energy moving. When your electromagnetic field is higher, more things are perceptible. We know this even through tests. You can do that as a preparatory step. The other aspect of the emotion is that the emotion itself will create a higher, a faster, stronger, thicker electromagnetic field.
Okay. I know exactly what you're talking about. That makes a lot of sense. You feel that slight magnetism in between your hands.
Exactly.
Like a ball or something. Okay.
That's right.
When
you feel the presence, you may feel it as a body tingling. That's the most common, a kind of a tingling. And sometimes it'll make people cry. It happens in workshops, for instance, where a person will be in one side of the room and the deceased will show up and almost everybody else in the room feels it and starts to cry or open up to it because it's all perceptible no matter how far away the rest of the participants are. So it's quite a common feeling, this tingling. It's the sort of thing that you feel when you have inspiration, which I think sometimes is often because there's a presence there giving you that inspiration. It's sort of goosebumpy. It's quite delicious, and it's full of information, too.
I'd like to switch gears just for a minute and ask you about something else that I have witnessed before, not in my personal life, but in someone else's life that I know. This person had a very tragic event happen to them. They died and came back. And after they woke back up, the person actually was traumatized by someone else very bad, violence. And then they self-medicated and died, and then they got resuscitated. And when they came back, they kept seeing a person hanging from the corner of the ceiling that was rotten. And when they looked very closely, everywhere they would go, they would see this person. When they looked very closely, it was it looked like themselves, but rotten. I don't know if that makes any sense. Is that a fragment of the soul?
No.
What is
that? No, I wouldn't say so. The death sounds to me that it's anchored in a past life or this experience. So I would say that that person is starting to objectify an inner experience that's making the event in this life so horrible. Another thing is that, do you follow me there?
Yes.
In other words, it triggers a past life memory that's so strong that it's actually objectified. It seems outside of you. And it's something that may have been avoided by this person, the knowledge of this life. On the other hand, because we have difficulty understanding that you can be dead and alive, we often imagine corpses living as though they, you know, worm infested or whatever, but alive, like the undead in films and whatnot, because we're trying to put together conflicting social ideas. One is the social idea of you're dead, the other one is perhaps a more intuitive idea, when you're dead, you're still alive. You're never more dead than you are now. So trying to get these two conflicting ideas together can produce some pretty bad dreams or visions, such as the one you just mentioned of being rotting and hanging.
But it sounds to be like this is a past life memory. I'm going to elaborate a little bit more, so maybe, because it might change your answer. Not that that's not an important answer or accurate answer, I just want to know. This person was my daughter. She was raped one time. And I found her dead in her bed. I was able to resuscitate her, and then she was on a ventilator for a few days. And when she woke up, she kept complaining about this girl hanging from the corner of the ceiling that looked rotten. Everywhere we would go, she would complain about this girl. My daughter is very spiritually awake. She's 19, but she lives with me, you know, and I've raised her with the non-dual perspective about spirituality and consciousness and intuition. And so one day we were sitting in our backyard. It was late at night, about 11 o'clock at night, and it was pitch black, and we were just sitting out there talking, and she said, "Mom, the dead girl's here." Well, unbeknownst to her, I was sitting in my chair, and I leaned back, and I hear auditorily. That's the way I get. I'm an intuitive, and that's how I get information.
Okay.
And I said, "Who is this?" And she said, "The apparition," or whatever it was, said, "Mom, it's me. It's Jessica. And it's dark, and I'm so scared, and I don't know what to do." And
Jessica your daughter?
Yes. And in reality, Jessica was sitting beside me and had no idea this conversation was going on.
Yeah.
And I said, "Honey, pick up your feet and rotate all the way around and look way off in the distance and see if you see a pinpoint of light." So there was silence for a moment. Then she said, "I do, but it's so far away. I can't do it." And I said, "Pick your feet up and float." So she said, "Okay." And after a few seconds, she goes, "I'm floating. I'm floating." And then she goes, "Oh, man. It feels so good," and boom, that was it. And then my daughter said, "Mom, the dead girl's gone. What happened there? Who was that dead girl?" And my daughter, in reality, had no idea that this was happening. So something happened there. What was it?
It could be a probable self, as strange as that sounds. Your daughter's death experience, dying experience, or close-to-death experience, could actually be mimicking or in time with a probable self. In other words, a version of Jessica in a kind of a multiverse.
Oh, like a parallel universe or something.
Yes.
Okay.
That's a really strong possibility. An even stronger one for me would be that when there's a strong trauma, either something like rape or whatever, we can throw off really deadly thought forms. And these thought forms can be so powerful and so human. They're not core personalities, but we can call them ghosts, for instance. They can even raise beds. I've worked with them, with those that were that strong. They're not core personalities. They're things that are produced in shock very often. And that kind of a thought form could very well be manifest all the fear in a certain metaphoric way. I would suspect that your daughter was in extreme trauma, and this was her way throwing some of that off and localizing it in a thought form metaphor was probably her best bet for keeping her sanity.
That's very interesting.
Ghosts are like that. They're fragments of the personality that are thrown off. It's usually obsessive-compulsive fragments. And working with them is fascinating, and they can respond. They generally don't have any interest in interaction. But I try to do it whenever I can. I certainly get hired to do that a lot. And I treat them as though they were core personalities, the full self, because some of them are magnificently developed.
So we have about 10 or 11 minutes, something like that. I'd like to give you the opportunity to talk about whatever you want to talk about in this. If you don't have
Thank
anything
you.
Specific,
I'm actually so
questions.
Interested in what's going on with you. I'm sorry
you
to say,
come live in my
really
house.
Really, what's going on with you?
Well, then I'll tell you, I'll ask you about something else then. My little boy, when he was about 5 years old, it was shortly after I got divorced, and my little boy's about 5 years old, and I get up every night about when I go to the bathroom, and I take him. I wake him up and take him to the bathroom. And so I did that and put him back to bed, and my little boy can sleep through a tornado or a bomb,
mm-hmm.
okay? He's like, because he's not home in the night, okay?
Right.
He's really not. But this one night, the next morning when I woke up, his light was on. That's never happened in his entire life. So I said, Derek, why is your light on? And he said, well, Mom, he goes, a ghost came to see me, and it wrote on my wall in green writing. And I don't understand, buddy. Explain to him. He said, well, it's like a little tiny green flashlight was writing on the wall and making letters, and it scared me. I said, what'd it say? And he went, I don't know. I can't read cursive. But what was that?
Well, that was a message.
Yeah.
You know, a message that got lost. And you know how many we have of these things when we're dreaming. We don't need to be dreaming to have them, but that's where we put all of our messages, in the dream state, or we think of them as residing in the zone of the imagination. It's a shame he couldn't have read it. It doesn't mean, too, that in a half-awake state in particular, that you don't see bleed-throughs from other dimensions. That can happen. In fact, we're all doing it all the time. We close our eyes and start to see faces of people who are very specific people, but we've never met them. They have no real relationship with us whatsoever, but they happen to be there. And this goes on all the time with us. Well, there's always a dream stream going on, whether you're awake or you're asleep. But when you're half awake, your tendency to see them as though they were exterior is much higher. So, I mean, I can't, I'd have to sort of be there in order to know specifically what that was, but I know that
have
for myself,
that?
I see a lot of people from the bed, things
have
happening,
you ever heard of
and
something
some
like
that have
that?
To do with me and some that don't.
Have you ever heard of something like that happening to anybody?
Well, I've heard lots of people awaken by things. Sometimes they're not so pleasant, but for the most part they are, very often by light, awakened by a very strong, very very specific light, or the whole room will start to light up when there's an appearance about to take place. Sometimes it can be just a ball of light and no person is there. And these, even though a person might know, a child, especially for children, might know it's the dead grandmother, Our culture does not support it, and it becomes frightening.
Mm-hmm.
And children, by the way, can often be frightened by visitations from parents because they're afraid, I believe, they're afraid that they have something, they're partly responsible for a parent's death because no one talks to them. the rejection and abandonment aspect is never worked through with a child. And so they carry this, you know, I could have done something if I'd been a better boy or a better girl, mommy would still be here, kind of thing. And so when a parent comes back, sometimes it will scare a child too. So all these are all factors to be considered. But I do want to stay in the remaining minutes. What I'm after is the elimination of the fear of death, and also to be able to help people make reconciliation and resolve, a tremendous healing power of after-death communication. It's even known to knock out post-traumatic stress disorder that could be generations long of intrusive memories, nightmares, sweat, suicide longing, depression, all that kind of stuff from the Korean War, say, or even World War II.
Hold on a minute, I'm lost.
Remaining,
I got lost.
Just came
got lost
out in one session.
I got lost after death communication. What did you say fixed PTSD?
Yeah.
My son
post-traumatic stress disorder.
From war, and actually, when he came back from war, I saw this.
And they have this terrible post-traumatic stress disorder, suicide longings, and repetitive nightmares and intrusive memories. And they go and talk to, they go into one of these therapies. There's many of them coming out now, induced after-death communication therapies of different types for different reasons. And we're just using a veteran here, goes in to one of these therapies, is put in communication with the deceased. The deceased come in, and all of that, 3 or 4 decades long of post-traumatic stress disorder, stops dead. It's amazing. The dead are the best bereavement counselors, the best counselors in general that we can ever have contact with. You are never more dead than you are now. That's the other thing. And if we understood that we don't have to wait until we die to be immortal, this would be quite a different world.
I'm just sitting here thinking, when my son came back from Iraq a couple of years ago, the day they were coming back, one of those suicide bomber things happened. They were actually driving to the base to come back over here. And there was a family, and a young girl survived, about 17, and he and his buddy ran over and tried to save her. But she said something like, "It's all your fault," or something like that, and then she died.
Right.
When he came back home, she followed him. And he doesn't believe in this kind of stuff, but it happened. And he called me one morning at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning, him and his buddy, back on the base at Fort Carson in Colorado. And these are grown men, 26, 7 years old, and they were sobbing. And they heard this growling noise and this big scratch. I saw this on Skype. My son called me on Skype. This big scratch appeared on his abdomen.
Wow.
And we actually had to get somebody to help make that go away. And then when he came home, I never experienced this. And I, quite frankly, I have a hard time believing it, but my son swears it happened. He said, I live up in the mountains, but he was living in my house in Atlanta, and he said that the bed would literally rock and roll, and that cabinets would open and slam. Does that really happen, or was that something in his head?
Yes, that happens. And usually that's not from... the deceased are almost never like that, and a good transition, forgiveness is the first rule. We have instances of people who have murdered, lying on their deathbeds, these murderers, and the murdered victims come in to forgive them before they die. So that's generally what happens. But if someone who died and is unprepared and angry, you can get quite a lot of activity. But usually these instances where there's a bureau moving across the room or paintings falling off the wall, and as I said, I've worked with some of this, usually that is something has something to do with a person who is alive and there with a lot of repressed energy.
So the energy was coming from him.
In this
him,
case,
like,
it could be your. It could have been generated by your own son's feelings about this death.
That makes so
instance.
Much sense.
Yeah.
William Rowell told me that one time too. He said poltergeist kind of activity is usually energy that's coming from a buildup somewhere.
Right.
You know,
usually
Bill
it's
Rowell,
a 13-year-old.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Well, you got 3 minutes. I didn't mean to take over the time that I offered you, but is there anything else you want to talk about?
Well, we can go back to this idea of what would it be like if you knew you were immortal? How much would change if there was no fear of death? How would dying change? It would be extraordinary if we knew that there was continuity. For certain, we knew that there was continuity between this world and the next. There's almost nothing that divides us. The human body is made primarily out of space. If you take all the space out of an atom, all the atoms of your body, you are left with a microscopic dot of matter. That is all you are. So, in terms of matter, so there's really very little that separates us from this world and the non-dimensional spheres. If we did understand our immortality, we would not have the greed, we would not have the overpopulation, we would not have a policed morality. This whole planet would change. And that's, I think, what will be coming in the next couple of hundred years. And I look forward to it, and I get peeks of it because I have somebody, an incarnation of mine 200 years from now, who gives me this information from time to time when I'm smart enough to access him. He thinks I'm an idiot from his perspective. We're really Stone Age.
So if someone wants to have you do this for them, how do they reach you?
Well, through the website. I've set up a teleconference-style thing where I can do things over the phone or I can do things on Skype. I'm all over the world. I'm going to Austria, first Germany, then Austria next week. So it doesn't stop. I'm back in the States at the end of the summer. I don't know how long I'll be here at the moment, but I'm back and forth all the time. So better to catch me with a teleconference call. I can do a life reading. That's something that people often ask of me, or whatever. And
what is a life reading entail? We got 1 minute. What is a life reading?
It's I do body and major issues and future and the whole thing about a person's life. Very often the dead come in during these sessions, and so I work with people to get them to have direct experience of the deceased. If I have it, it's much more diluted for them. Their experience is not as strong. They don't get the real change. So I work very hard to get the other person I'm working for to feel and directly communicate with the deceased themselves. That's a big part of what I do, to be their own mediums.
I think that's a very important thing.
It lasts longer. The effects last longer. And you can always keep doing it once we hang up the phone or I'm out of the picture.
Thank you, Dr. Asant, for taking time to come on my show tonight. And I hope that you will come back sometime.
Thank you, Eva, and good luck to you and what you're going through.
Thank you, and good night.
Night.